You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Shadows in the Valley by Joe Hagan. I don't have to walk in and suck up all the oxygen, Kana tells me. I can listen. People often describe me as a listener, right? Maybe after the bombast, the ugliness of what's going on, the simple chance of embodying American decency and kindness and empathy and listening and substance, which is also a strain in the American story, right? For every Donald Trump character, there are also those characters. And our country is so beautiful and diverse, and there's room for all, and maybe people are drawn to it. After Connor got poleaxed by Stephen A. Smith on Bill Maher's show in January, he received a note from the actor Jesse Eisenberg, who had also appeared on the panel, and said the exchange felt emblematic of this moment, but also every moment when the thoughtful person is drowned out by the loud person. Not that Connor isn't trying to adapt. In February, he went after Musk on X over the unchecked slash and burn of the federal government, prompting Musk to snap back, "Don't be a dick." Kana turned the exchange into a TikTok video promising to be the biggest dick in Congress if transparency isn't forthcoming. I ask about the exchange, and Kana again invokes Tracy in Johnstown. By endangering her mother's health care, he says, Musk is giving Democrats a message they can run on. I can already imagine the bumper sticker in 2026, he tells me. Don't fire veterans and don't take away Medicaid. It's a very long bumper sticker, I tell him. We're somewhere between Milwaukee and Chicago when the subject of Bannon first comes up. The Rasputin of the far right went to prison in 2024, for refusing to testify before Congress about his role in the January 6th insurrection. By the time Kana and I are talking, he's back on top, gabbing with Newsom on Newsom's podcast, giving a long interview to Ross Duttet of the New York Times, critiquing the failures of Democrats, attacking Musk, espousing the importance of reviving American industry, and sounding very much like Kana. I've known Bannon since he was a lawyer in Hollywood, trading in gossip about players like Mike Ovitz and Ron Burkle, the California grocery store magnate and old pal of Clinton. Bannon had a financial stake in Seinfeld and earned residuals from the show before becoming a populist firebrand. I text Bannon to say I'm with Kana, and he instantly shoots back. He's a rock star. Kana is delighted when I read the text and jokes that Bannon might want to endorse him in his next race. He thinks that the economic patriotism idea I have can be a successful vision for our party, surmises Kana. Having an Indian-American son of immigrants, talking about why we need steel in Johnstown, I mean, that's probably what intrigues people like Bannon. Here's a Stanford econ grad, Indian-American guy, saying, boy, those politicians were dumb to take away the industrial base. And yeah, we've got to rebuild it. And nations matter. And you can't just have unlimited free flow of global capital. It all makes perfect sense. 2 weeks later, I meet with Bannon on the 8th floor of the Pierre Hotel in Manhattan, where he's padding around in stockinged feet and his signature rumpled field general chic, long hair greased back, belly hanging out, looking like a founding father after a weekend ayahuasca trip. Kana's economic patriotism motif, Bannon declares, is stealing our shit. Yeah, he's put a new title on it. He's trying to make America great again and put even more stars and stripes on it. Bannon is all in on Khanna's vision of marrying Silicon Valley wealth to middle American industry, but the Broligarchs will never do it. They're in the algorithm business. As Bannon envisions it, the battle for the future is between the tech leaders in Khanna's district who want to put computer chips in the heads of their customers and plug them into artificial intelligence, the transhumanist he calls them, and the normal, analog, non-billionaire class he says he's fighting for. I'm on Team Homo sapiens. Bannon split with Musk over the issue of H-1B visas, which allows Silicon Valley companies to import skilled engineers from India and China, and which Khanna and Musk both support. When Vivek Ramaswamy, Musk's would-be partner in Doge, said H-1B visas are necessary because American workers are mediocre, he exposed the canyon between Bannon's movement and the tech oligarchs with whom Trump has allied himself. Bannon refers to these Indian engineers in Silicon Valley as indentured servants. I think it's terrible what we do with these Indian kids, he says. I mean, it's an effing ghetto there, but the oligarchs love it. They love the fact these guys live 6 to a 2-bedroom in Silicon Valley because they're working 20 effing hours a day at these companies. I ask Bannon to advise Khanna on how he can succeed politically. He needs a rally point, Bannon says, and that rally point is to tell Dems they were lied to by the Democratic establishment. Yeah, you've been crushed. Yeah, you were sold a false narrative. That's why, right now, as hard as we had it, Democrats have it harder. They think they were lied to. Khanna has a tough road ahead, Bannon says, because Democrats can't credibly talk to the working class. Populism is not easy, he says. You have to really believe it. Nobody in your party believes it. I think the reason he's a breath of fresh air is he's a decent guy, Bannon concludes. He's not one of these know-it-alls on MSNBC telling you you're bad, you're evil, you're stupid, but he needs critical mass and wins, process, and content. I mentioned Khanna's theory that rebuilding industry in MAGA country might make people stop hating on immigrants and trans people, the stuff Trump and Bannon exploited for years to build the MAGA following. Theoretically, that might be true, he snaps, but it's also a masturbatory fantasy. First off, you have to be in power, which you're not. The easier solution? For Khanna to switch to the Republican Party and go full MAGA, which Bannon predicts Khanna will do within 18 months. He'll eventually be a Republican, he says. Of course he will. He's out there with the oligarchs. They're all right-wingers now. I can practically see Bannon's tail wagging. Bannon aims to recruit both Khanna and Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman to join the MAGA ranks. They're my top two targets, he declares. You understand, if we flip Fetterman and Ro Khanna, Democrats got nothing. They have no intellectual fire. My top target in 16 was Tulsi Gabbard. Ro needs a year in the wilderness to see how hard it is to change the Democratic apparatus. Considering reports of Fetterman's erratic and tempestuous behavior behind the scenes, he may be the ripest of Bannon's targets. The big difference between Khanna's brand of populism and Bannon's version, I am at pains to point out, is that Khanna envisions a multiracial society and not a white nationalist autocracy. Bannon comes back with the familiar argument that MAGA made big inroads with black and Hispanic voters in 2024, adding, for good measure, I'm the chairman of the Hindu Republican Society, misremembering the actual name of the group, Republican Hindu Coalition. Bannon the cynic views people as transactional. As far as he's concerned, Khanna, whose name Bannon repeatedly mispronounces as Khanna, could help MAGA's quote of non-whites. In the populist nationalist movement, he suggests, Khanna could be the guy that actually brings in the South Asians. And it's open. We want it. I would love to be able to convert him. A week later, Bannon complicates plans when he makes a Nazi-like gesture at the Conservative Political Action Conference. Bannon reveals that he's exchanged a few texts with Khanna, advising him, first, you got to go back to your effing district and take care of those GD oligarchs you've loosed on the world. Before I depart, I show Bannon the social media exchange in which Khanna promises Musk he'll be the biggest dick in Congress. That's not bad. It's a start, says Bannon. You got to start somewhere. The bromance of Khanna and Bannon highlights an uncomfortable truth. The success of Trumpism has so utterly reshaped American political reality that Democrats, if they are ever to win again, must absorb its cruel lessons. Khanna, in effect, is promising a kinder, gentler version of Trumpism, Blue MAGA, as Khanna had joked. Maybe he'll convince Bannon to flip to his side, he jokes. But it's not that funny. I think that he is right, Khanna admits, after I read him Bannon's political advice. You have to be willing to take the fight to the establishment with no mercy. It can't be Pollyannish. The establishment screwed you. In that, I totally agree with him. Looking back, 2016 was a world historic fork in the road. Democrats may have had a chance to cut Trump off at the pass by nominating the populist insurgent Sanders for president, but the establishment standard bearer also offered the irresistible prospect of becoming the first woman president. The what if grows starker in the rear view. I think the Democratic Party in 2016 wouldn't have allowed me to be a populist, muses Khanna. I couldn't have smashed the Democratic Party myself, but Bannon and Trump did it for us, and there's a rebirth, and it's a free-for-all. I joked to Khanna that he should rebrand himself Bro-Khanna and start drinking protein shakes. Try selling himself to the trad white males who support Trump. I don't think that the party wins by becoming Trump-like, he says, by dressing like Trump, by mimicking Trump's cursing, by mimicking Trump's crudeness. Why would we? Why would that be authentic? I mean, we win by being the opposite. Khanna's cardinal faith is that pure economics can beat culture war issues with a dose of sympathy for white fragility. They were in classes where they were told the future is female, Khanna observes. Of aggrieved white males in America, they feel that people don't realize how hard it is for them, and they don't feel seen or heard. And so our message to them shouldn't be, you know, it's time to reassert manliness in American society at the expense of women. Our message to them should be, we see that a declining economy where we offshored all these jobs, where we let wealth pile up in a few places, has left you without real economic opportunity. Khanna, like every other Democrat, is surfing a fast-moving political wave, trying to keep his balance amid the daily shocks of the Trump administration. In the course of reporting this story, Trump launches a global trade war, heralding a renaissance of American industrialization, extracting a promise of $100 billion in new U.S. manufacturing from Taiwanese chipmaker TSMC. On the surface, it's the kind of development Khanna would otherwise support, given his passion for rebuilding industry. He has the same aim, but by the wrong means, he says of Trump. It's not going to work. I just disagree with how he's doing it. In March, when Trump threatens to defund the CHIPS Act, I sense the walls closing in on Khanna's populism. Frustrated, Khanna texts me, Trump beckons foreign firms instead of building American capacity. By gutting CHIPS, Trump is not giving American industry any chance to develop. Khanna again trains his fire on Vance, whose home state of Ohio could now lose a planned Intel facility projected to create some 10,000 new jobs. How can you be for rebuilding the industrial base and watch that disappear, he asked, suggesting Vance will be politically damaged when he runs for president in 2028, if any of it is remembered. In the spring, Khanna starts a series of rallies in Republican districts in California, focusing on veterans and federal workers hurt by DOGE cuts, pulling larger-than-usual crowds with a populist benefits-over-billionaires message, allying himself with the barnstorming Bernie Sanders and AOC. "I see it as the wing with the most energy," says Khanna of the Progressives. "It's a vindication tour for Bernie. You should have listened to me." Even when Trump's approval rating finally takes a dip below 40% in April, Khanna and the Democrats are still looking for an argument, an opening, a wedge, a foot in the door, a breeze at their backs, momentum of any kind. They need a fresh face, a new voice. Khanna? Well, nobody looks possible until one day they do. See also Trump. "What wakes up the American people?" Khanna asked. "I understand that there are things that the government can do more efficiently, but democratic projects are hard. It's hard to get people to do things, to build things for the economy. It's a hard thing." A lot of people believe Trumpism is here to stay, that America is on the slow glide to fascism, or the fast glide. Maybe we're already there. Or maybe Trump's tariff gambit will work, and Democrats will look like obstructionist fools in the grand scheme of history. Isn't that the exhilarating part of American democracy, Khanna says? It's that we don't know. We don't know whether my ideas are going to work or connect. But that's the process. On my flight home from California, where I had toured Khanna's home turf of Silicon Valley, I watched Gary Oldman portray Winston Churchill in the 2017 film Darkest Hour. Director Joe Wright's Churchill, facing impossible odds and no good options against the Nazi threat, finds his voice and his spine by sounding out opinions from regular folks riding the London Tube, inspiring the "We Shall Fight on the Beaches" speech to Parliament. The movie ends on a stark quote, "Success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts." In April, I called Tracy in Johnstown to ask how her mother is doing and whether Trump is helping her cause. "Not really, no," she tells me. "I just feel like there was a bunch of promises made that are just not being addressed. This will change, that will change. I understand that it's only been since January, but there's nothing changing." Operating costs for Red's Texas Barbecue have gone up 40% in the past year, she says. "I can't blame it on Trump because he wasn't in office," Tracy says, "but he's claiming so much that he's going to fix. I know it's not going to happen overnight, but I just don't see anything happening. I just don't see anything moving." Tracy's mother developed pneumonia after Khanna and I left town and had to be flown to a hospital in Pittsburgh. The bill for the 20-minute helicopter ride was $60,000. Imagine if she didn't have insurance, Tracy says. Tracy worries about it absolutely every day. I ask Tracy whether Democrats could ever break through in Johnstown. She compares working-class voters to pit bulls. "So pit bulls have a bad name just because they're pit bulls," she says. "But if you get a pit bull and you love it, and you nurture it, you raise it, and you put care and concern into it, it'll be the best, most loyal dog you've ever had." Tracy says Khanna's attention made an impression on her. She wasn't the only one in Johnstown who told me that. "He came all the way from California, here, to this little hole in the wall, to a place that is privately owned, instead of going to Applebee's," she says. "That was promising, definitely. It's a start." Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis, Kevin Bacon, the bondsman actor on Marriage, Bullshit, and his perfectly unique nose. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A family dinner, candlelight, lots of laughs. What is your favorite journey? The last leg of any journey home. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My nose looks like a two-car garage. What or who is the greatest love of your life? She's in the next room. What is your most marked characteristic? I guess the two-car garage. Let's put it this way. If I'm walking through a crowd and want to avoid being recognized, I just cover my nose. No doubt your caricature will be featuring it. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I truly don't think about historical figures that much. Maybe it's no accident that I've rarely played one. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Probably our first dog. Her name was Jane. Pretty great life. Free spirit. Although she was accident prone. What is your greatest fear? Food and a sink drain. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I can't stand the way my voice will crack if I'm making a speech. I hate public speaking and the emotion it dredges up. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Lying. Let's not call it untruthful or factually inaccurate. I don't even call it bullshit because I like bulls and bulls need to shit. So you can't hold that against them. Let's call it what it is. Lying. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Physical appearance. On what occasion do you lie? Sometimes it's necessary backstage after a screening or when someone just played a song for you. Which living person do you most despise? It's a growing list, but I wouldn't write it here as we live in an age of weaponized retribution. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Like, as in, I was like, what does that even mean? It's noncommittal. What is your greatest regret? Not practicing the guitar. When and where were you happiest? I have to believe that my happiest days are ahead of me. Otherwise, the future looks miserable. What is your current state of mind? It's always shifting, even in the flash of a moment. Anxious, excited, peaceful, hopeful, and back to anxious. What is it that you most dislike? Questions about our marriage. I hate to take decades of partnership and distill it into a soundbite. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My family. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? I'm going to take this opportunity to say I don't want to come back. I don't believe I will. I want to do my best while I'm here because I believe that when I'm gone, I'm gone. What is your most treasured possession? I guess an old guitar, but I'm not too attached to possessions. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Whenever I see a parent who has lost a child to war or shootings or disease, that seems like unimaginable misery. What do you most value in your friends? They want nothing but friendship. Who are your favorite writers? Cormac McCarthy, Barbara Kingsolver, Stephen King. How would you like to die? Without pain. What are your favorite names? Travis and Sosie. I'm not kidding. I love these names. They also happen to be our kids' names. We got the names off crew list of movies that Kira was shooting while pregnant. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Kevin Bacon.
Thank you.
Peak TV. 35 years after its debut, David Lynch's Twin Peaks still exudes paranormal cool. For its obsessive fans, including many born after it first aired, The Mystery is the Message by Mike Hogan. Opening photo montage, try that in a small town. The Twin Peaks phenomenon was such that it made icons out of some unlikely people, places, and things. Pictured, Laura Palmer's homecoming photo, Agent Dale Cooper and his trusty microcassette recorder, the log lady and her beloved piece of Douglas fir, the giant with his bow tie, and the man from another place in the Red Room, Cheryl and Finn's vertiginously peaked eyebrows, and many more. On the morning of January 16th, Kyle MacLachlan was working out in his home gym high in the hills above Los Angeles when his wife came to the door and said, "I have some terrible news." David Lynch, the director who discovered MacLachlan and made him a star, was dead. "I didn't collapse," MacLachlan says, "but everything went right out of me." Everyone knew Lynch was battling emphysema, but MacLachlan didn't think he was dying. Just a few weeks earlier, he and Laura Dern had visited Lynch at his house down the road. "We always kept a distance because he didn't want to catch anything. His lungs were so fragile. But he was chipper, and we were talking about the next thing we might want to do and trying to figure out how he could direct from a remote location." In 1983, Lynch plucked MacLachlan from obscurity and cast him as Paul Atreides in Dune. After it bombed, Lynch stunned MacLachlan by casting him again in Blue Velvet. Then came his role as Agent Dale Cooper in Twin Peaks, the TV series that Lynch co-created with writer Mark Frost. MacLachlan knows that's the one he'll always be remembered for. Even Lynch tended to conflate him with his character. "Whether it was Kyle or Coop, sometimes it was blurry," MacLachlan says. Not that he minded. They were friends and colleagues, both off-screen and on. Lynch cast himself in the show as FBI Deputy Director Gordon Cole, Coop's boss and secret sharer. Twin Peaks, in David's mind, was a living, breathing thing, MacLachlan says, and I think part of why he enjoyed being Gordon Cole was he could actually enter that world. Lynch may be gone, but the world of Twin Peaks lives on. The show premiered on April 8, 1990, and immediately rewrote the rules of TV. For mainstream viewers, it was a clever evening soap with a riveting murder mystery. For those with artier taste, it was a revelation. Its quirky characters and bizarre twist marked a turn from the glossy maximalism of the 80s to the eccentric detachment of a new decade whose zeitgeist it helped define. Everything about Twin Peaks was cool. The tone, the dialogue, the music, even the setting. Just a short drive from the spot where grunge was about to erupt. "This is kind of a simplistic understatement," says Lost co-creator Damon Lindelof, "but it had a vibe. The series commanded public mindshare at a scale no longer imaginable for a network drama. People flocked to Twin Peaks viewing parties. Supermarket bakeries churned out cherry pies on Thursday nights. And everyone wanted to know who killed the beautiful but tormented homecoming queen, Laura Palmer. The show's young stars became offbeat sex symbols overnight. Its popularity was surprising to all of us," says Madkin Amick, who was just 18 when she first played Shelley Johnson. "It was just this fervor of fandom. I appreciated the enthusiasm, but it was very, very hard to navigate being so new in the industry." Then, just as suddenly, the show flamed out. In barely more than a year, ABC shut it down. According to the New York Times, the normies had grown frustrated by the show's refusal to solve its central mystery, while the Lynchians were grossed out by its popularity. A year later, Lynch's film spinoff, Fire Walk With Me, flopped, and that, it seemed, was red curtains for Twin Peaks. Except it wasn't. Fans tried to save Twin Peaks from cancellation, flooding ABC Entertainment chief Robert Iger's office with firewood in honor of the show's famous log lady, who carries around a hunk of Douglas fir that transmits messages from another dimension. And fans have kept the phenomenon alive for decades now, all but manifesting a 2017 sequel series on Showtime. The fans began the drumbeat, and David and Mark got back together, says McLaughlin. Twin Peaks fans over-index among TV writers who have smuggled its sensibility and paranormal intrigue into everything from The X-Files and Lost to Stranger Things. Probably 99.99% of the work that I've done since then is rooted in the filmmakers being fans of Twin Peaks and of David Lynch, says Amick, who went on to star in Riverdale. Today's severance obsessives trading wild theories on Reddit are the heirs of the early adopters who dissected Twin Peaks on Usenet. About a year ago, I found myself compulsively rewatching the entire 53-hour Twin Peaks filmography, the first two seasons, the film Fire Walk With Me, the outtakes collection The Missing Pieces, and the Showtime sequel series Twin Peaks The Return. Because I wasn't worried about spoilers, I Googled everything that confused me, which was a lot. I discovered a surprisingly active community of fans sharing theories, explanations, and annotations. Not only on Reddit, Discord, and YouTube, but in fanzines and books. Some had deeply unrealistic ideas of how TV shows are made, and a lot of their notions were patently absurd. But I came much closer to unlocking the show's mysteries with their help than I ever could have without it. They were, as the old Zen saying goes, fingers pointing at the moon. The goal is to find the moon, not the fingers. Or, as Lynch famously said, keep your eye on the donut and not on the hole. I don't think Twin Peaks can be fully understood without the fans. It's as if, by leaving so much unresolved, Lynch and Frost made room for them. They created a vacuum, which their enthusiasts have filled with ideas, art, and a sense of community whose dynamics aren't so different from those of a classic American small town. The more Twin Peaks I consumed, the more I felt that its true meaning was just beyond my grasp. There were clues and references everywhere I looked, to Vedic scriptures and theosophical precepts, yes, but also to old movies and pulp magazines. The rational part of me knew there was no ultimate secret to unseal. It's just a TV show, but I kept digging anyway. What does Twin Peaks mean? That was the question that haunted me. To answer it, I began to research how the show was made, but I also studied the people who have kept it alive. Next photos, David Lynch with Twin Peaks co-creator Mark Frost in Culver City, California, in 1990. Lynch with Christabel, his longtime musical collaborator, and Twin Peaks The Return co-star in Los Angeles in 2012. We were 100% on the same wavelength. Mark Frost was living in Minneapolis in 1979 when he caught a midnight screening of Lynch's experimental breakthrough feature, Eraserhead. It blew my mind, Frost remembers, and I walked out of there with the conviction that he and I would work together someday. At just 26, Frost had already had a brief but promising run as a television writer in Hollywood. A child of theater people, he'd moved back to Minneapolis to focus on writing plays, but soon tired of freezing through the winter on a playwright's budget. In 1981, he accepted an invitation from a mentor, Stephen Bochco, to join the Hill Street Blues writers' room. A police procedural set in an unnamed city, Hill Street Blues lit the fuse for the coming explosion of prestige dramas. Its complex characters and multi-episode story arcs felt revolutionary in a Dukes of Hazzard era. Frost joined for the third season. Among the writers was David Milch, who would go on to create Deadwood for HBO. Hill Street Blues, Frost later said, was his postgraduate degree in making a television show, so he was ready when his agent, Tony Krantz, introduced him to Lynch. Next photos, Lynch, during production of the Twin Peaks pilot episode. Laura Dern's Diane confronts Mr. C., Cooper's evil doppelganger, in The Return. Kyle MacLachlan and Cheryl Lee at the front door of Mary Reber's house in the final episode of The Return. So began a game-changing collaboration. The drama would come later. A capacious reader with a taste for eccentric topics, conspiracy theories, occult religions, UFOs, Frost was a ride-or-die liberal Democrat whose great-uncle had worked for FDR. Lynch had an itinerant childhood owing to his dad's job as a USDA research scientist and spent time in Montana, Idaho, Washington State, North Carolina, and Virginia. Trained as a painter and devoted to transcendental meditation, he was always on the lookout for ideas, often images bubbling up from his unconscious. On set, he tried to be present in the moment and take advantage of what he called happy accidents. There have been many attempts to make sense of the Frost-Lynch symbiosis. Lynch is the artist, Frost is the writer. Lynch is left brain, Frost is right. Lynch's long involvement with TM suggests an East-West split, philosophically speaking, but in fact, Frost is well-versed in all forms of spirituality. His fluency in Theosophism, a 19th-century effort to bring all the world's mythologies together under a single scientific system, certainly came in handy as he set about trying to translate Lynch's freaky flashes of inspiration into lore worthy of Tolkien or Lucas. Krantz suggested that Frost and Lynch adapt Goddess, a book by Anthony Summers about Marilyn Monroe's secret tryst with JFK and RFK. The project died, but the two men stayed in touch. We were 100% on the same wavelength, Lynch later said. We were laughing and writing and laughing and writing. They wrote a bizarre comic screenplay called One Saliva Bubble, then worked up an even weirder treatment called The Lemurians, about a secret race of 7-foot-tall, egg-laying humanoids. Sadly, both fell through. In 1986, Blue Velvet, Lynch's film about a clean-cut young man's descent into the criminal underworld, became an arthouse smash. People were starting to use the term Lynchian to describe an all-American milieu with a dark underbelly. That's when Lynch and Frost pitched ABC on a show about a small town with secrets, where nothing is as it seems. The executives were a little afraid of Lynch, but Frost seemed sane, and the hybrid of evening soap opera and detective mystery they sketched was appealing. Every once in a while, someone in Hollywood falls so far behind the competition that they decide they might as well try something different. So ABC, trailing NBC and CBS badly, greenlit Frost and Lynch's weird thing. "We just went for it," Frost remembers. "And having the television experience that David did not have, I simply said, let's ride this for as long and as hard as we can, because we'll never get a chance like this again." The two co-creators would own the series itself, a detail that would help shape its future. Lynch didn't ask actors to read from a script. Instead, he sat with them and had a conversation. He trusted his intuition. Harry Goes, who plays the open-hearted cop deputy Andy, was Lynch's driver. Frank DeSilva, who plays the evil entity Bob, was a set dresser. Lynch got the idea to use him after overhearing someone on set warn Silva not to lock himself inside a room. "In my head, I see Frank locked in Laura Palmer's room, and I just had a feeling, Lynch says in the 2018 book Room to Dream. And that's just the way ideas come. Where do they come from? They're all gifts. Lynch, then 43, directed the two-hour pilot in early 1989. It was a feature film, effectively, shot on location in Washington's Snoqualmie Valley, 30 miles east of Seattle. The cast was a mix of industry vets and newcomers. None knew what to expect from this unusual project. In the opening moments of the pilot, Pete Martell, played by Eraserhead star Jack Nance, discovers Laura Palmer's body on the beach under a giant log. She's dead, wrapped in plastic, he tells Sheriff Harry S. Truman on the phone. As the episode unfolds, we encounter one suspicious local after another. Everyone seems to have something to hide and some reason to want Laura dead. We also meet Cooper, the ostensible star of the show, a friendly FBI agent with a taste for cherry pie and a rare willingness to plumb his own unconscious for clues. He is an avatar of Lynch himself, but he also represents us, the audience. We want to know who killed Palmer, and it's his job to find out. ABC's executives were unsure about the pilot until test audiences started flipping for it. I was in a rotisserie baseball league with Mark, and he said, "Come see this pilot I made with David Lynch," recalls Harley Payton, who went on to write for the show. I congratulated him afterwards and said, "I've never really written for television, but if you need anyone to come and help write a script..." The network gave Twin Peaks a slot as a mid-season replacement. The pilot's Snoqualmie Valley locations were hastily approximated in and around Los Angeles. Frost took charge of the production and wrote the short season's finale himself, stuffing it full of cliffhangers to maximize their chances of getting renewed. Next photos, shooting the discovery of Laura Palmer's body on the beach. McLaughlin and Michael Unkin, Sheriff Harry S. Truman, shooting a scene at the train car where Laura was killed. Lee as Laura's cousin Maddie Ferguson, Lara Flynn Boyle as Donna Hayward, and James Marshall as biker with a heart of gold, James Hurley. Adele Jones and Christabel at a Comic-Con International fan event in 2018. A wizard programmer. A decade earlier, CBS had run a wildly successful advertising campaign for its evening soap, Dallas, with a tagline, "Who shot JR?" Now, ABC put its marketing muscle behind the question, "Who killed Laura Palmer?" It worked, and millions of Americans were soon demanding an answer. Some fans dialed into the show's more eccentric frequencies, too. Damon Lindelof, then 16, was one of them. He and his dad were big Eraserhead fans. When they found out Lynch was doing a TV show, they eagerly tuned in. "Watching that TV show, every single neuron in my brain fired," Lindelof remembers. His father recorded each episode on VHS. "When it was over," he says, "we would immediately watch it again, fast-forwarding through the commercials to analyze all the clues." By 1990, just about every home in America had a VCR. Only a few had a modem. But for technologically savvy fans, having the power to rewatch an episode, freeze frames of special interest, and then share your observations in real time was a thrilling development. In a 1995 paper analyzing the Usenet newsgroup Alt-TV Twin Peaks, MIT literature professor Henry Jenkins quoted one fan as saying, "Can you imagine Twin Peaks coming out before VCRs or without the net? It would have been hell." The mostly male fans who frequented Alt-TV Twin Peaks had a discernible set of preoccupations. Jenkins noted their fixation on resolving narrative enigmas, their complex relationship to Lynch as author, and their perceptions of themselves as sophisticated television viewers. They had a hacker mentality, Jenkins observed, and created a mental model of Lynch in their own image. Lynch's authorial identity emerged in the net discourse as both that of a wizard programmer, he wrote, and that of a trickster who consistently anticipates and undermines audience expectations. The fans trading theories on Reddit, Discord, and YouTube today aren't so different from their Usenet predecessors. If anything, the sprawling and open-ended Twin Peaks, The Return, supercharged the theory economy among fans and bolstered the impression of Lynch, who directed all 18 hours as an all-knowing auteur imbuing every frame with arcane meaning. Lynch and Frost, for their part, have always steadfastly refused to say what deeper meaning, if any, the show might have. David and I began with an agreement that we both advocated for, says Frost, which is just write it and make it and don't explain it and let people reach their own conclusions. The most successful exercise in fan theorizing to date is also the most controversial. In 2019, a 33-year-old YouTuber named Ross Riblett posted a video titled Twin Peaks Actually Explained. No, really, over the course of 4.5 hours, yes, hours. He lays out his case that Lynch's goal with Twin Peaks was to use the unsolved mystery of Laura Palmer to counter the desensitizing effects of mainstream TV, which presented murders as puzzles to be solved neatly and quickly for the amusement of complacent couch potatoes. When the network forced Lynch to solve his own puzzle, he blamed the audience and, well, there's a lot more. Riblett's video, which has 3.3 million views, became a flashpoint among longtime fans. Some were grateful to him for shedding light on the show's enduring riddles. Others felt he had violated the spirit of the Enterprise. The way I like to evaluate media is, what was the original guy saying, even though David Lynch would say that that's not the way he wants you to see it, Riblett admits. He and pretty much the entire fan base will tell you it's up to the viewer, and I don't disagree. It's just that my video is about what David Lynch was bringing to it. To Scott Ryan, publisher of the Blue Rose fanzine and author of several books about Twin Peaks, Riblett's video was a classic example of Lynch-splaining. If someone says, I'm going to tell you what Twin Peaks is about, get up and go. That's your signal. This person doesn't get it, and they're actually afraid of it. Then again, Ryan acknowledged Riblett's video was orders of magnitude more successful than any of his videos. Riblett spent 2 years on his explainer video. John Thorne spent 4 writing Ominous Whoosh, A Wandering Mind Returns to Twin Peaks. The co-editor of Wrapped in Plastic, an influential fanzine published from 1992 to 2005, he argues that virtually all of The Return is filtered through Cooper's mind. Knowing the show's production history, however, Thorne approached the exercise with deep humility. You had powerful creators, sometimes working in sync, and sometimes working at odds, he says, and the work developed in a way that could never have been planned. The average fan spinning theories on Reddit tends to ignore Frost completely and ascribe omniscient intentionality to Lynch. But as Harley Payton points out, Lynch's real genius was to go with the flow in interesting ways. I remember there was an autopsy scene in the pilot, and the lights started flickering on the set. Now, usually, that's a 2-hour delay while someone thinks, what the hell is going on with the lights? But David was like, no, no, this is neat, let's do this. It's a lot of fun, but it's also brilliant. The truth is hard to get at. The eternal effort to discern a grand design within Twin Peaks meets its greatest obstacle in the wildly uneven second season. Careerism, clashing egos, network politics, audience pushback, and the relentless demands of weekly TV production all took their toll. After a glorious 17-episode run, culminating in the resolution of the Laura Palmer mystery and the death of her father Leland, the show went off the rails. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.